Welcome once again to our second series on the Da Vinci Code, or deciphering the Da Vinci Code. Most of you know probably that the Da Vinci Code was a very famous novel written by Dan Brown, made into a movie, recently has come out in video, and even some kind of games have been given to the younger generation about the Da Vinci Code. And the reason we're discussing it so much is because that it has so many explosive statements, very, very untrue statements against Christianity, the whole heart of Christianity, the divinity of Christ, and the setting up of the church by Jesus, and claims that even though it's a historical novel, that this is based on very thorough and good research that the church has for so many centuries kept under wrap, because it would be a real destruction of what the Catholic Church claims and what Christianity claims. So my guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches history and religion at, I think also, aren't you teaching government also? Some classes
yes,
of government,
sure I am, yes.
At John Paul II Catholic High here at St. Patrick's. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick's Parish. Last time we gave the first part of the novel, and we're going to summarize just a couple of sentences to help us continue about the story itself, in case those who, some people have not read it. So, Ron, could you just say a few words about kind of summarizing?
Yes, without recapitulating what we said the last time, unraveling the mystery, which is developed, requires a solution to a series of riddles, including anagrams and number puzzles. And solving these puzzles leads to secondary clues, or these clues leads to secondary clues, such as Leonardo da Vinci and the Mona Lisa, and then later on the Last Supper, and these clues in turn lead to other clues, which lead to other clues.
Okay.
So it's the first about third of the book is actually just that evening, the first evening of the murder, and when all this what we described last week was going on. I think the whole novel, all 454 pages of it, only goes about 3 days, if I recall right, over about 3 days. But the main mysteries of the novel are, what secret was Saunier, he was the curator, of course, there,
who was murdered
at the Louvre, what secret was he protecting that led to his murder, and then who is the mastermind behind the murder? And the solution is to be found with the location of the Holy Grail, and to a mysterious society called the Priory of Sion, as well as the Knights Templar, and the Catholic organization Opus Dei also plays a prominent role in the mystery as well.
Okay, so perhaps we could just go on from there. We were up to where Langdon and Sophie, what have they been learning as they work together on their detective work?
Yes, this is over the 2 days or so, 3 days, when they're trying to solve these clues. And they're trying to crack the Da Vinci Code, in other words.
Okay.
Well, they discovered that Jacques Saunier, that's her grandfather, Sophia's grandfather, was the Grand Master of the Priory of Sion, and therefore knew the hidden location of the keystone which leads to the Holy Grail, and documents that would shake the foundations of Christianity and the Catholic Church, according to the novel.
Sure.
They learned that he was killed by an Opus Dei albino monk named Silas, who shot him in an attempt to get this information from him. Silas had already eliminated other top members of the Priory of Sion. I think there was three others, if I recall right, that he had murdered just that very evening, or at least within a day's time. The book falsely portrays Opus Dei as a mysterious secret organization that will do anything to keep the secret from being revealed to the world, even commit murder in this particular case. The novel alleges that this organization first rose to prominence in the church after it transferred $1 billion to the Vatican Bank, that was about to go bankrupt. And the novel claims that it wasn't long after that that the cause for canonization of the founder, Jose Maria Escriva, was accelerated. We also learned that Saunier had a personal stake in the secret because he and his granddaughter, Sophie, were in the Merovingian royal line, French dynasty, royal dynasty. And I'll say more about this French dynasty later on, but ultimately this means, according to the novel, that they could trace their bloodlines back to Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
Now, by solving the clues, Langdon and Sophie find the keystone, which is a cylindrical device invented by Leonardo da Vinci for transporting secret messages. Whether he really did have an invention like that, I don't know. You know, he had all kinds of drawings and ideas, and he was a real, of course, Renaissance
very
man.
Creative
very creative
thinker.
Creative man, yes. Not only, in other words, an artist, a famous artist, sculpture and painting, but he also was a scientist, one of the leading scientists of his day. And this cylindrical device, this keystone, as it was called, in order to get it open, the combination of rotating components had to be arranged in the correct order. And if one tried to force it open, an enclosed vial of vinegar would break and dissolve the message, which was made out of, was written on papyrus.
Okay.
Which is, you know, very delicate material that could easily be destroyed by vinegar or some kind of caustic liquid. Well, Langdon is able to figure out the combination on a flight while fleeing to England on Sir Lee Teabing's plane. Teabing is an unscrupulous historian who had learned about the Priory of Sion and the secret it had been keeping for centuries. And he believed that the Priory had been protecting documents for many centuries that told the real story of the Holy Grail. He had discovered the identities of the leaders of the Priory, and he had bugged their offices. Also, he tricked a bishop to finance Opus Dei to help him find the Grail. However, he had no intention of handing it over to the bishop when he found it, because the church wanted to keep it a secret. And he wanted to reveal it to the world, of course, this Sir Lee Teabing, this historian, who Robert Langdon and Sophie had linked up with. Teabing believed that the Priory of Sion had broken its vow to reveal the secret of the Grail to the world at the appointed time, which was the year 2000. Which ended the age of Pisces, or the age of the fish, which was the main symbol of the early Christians.
Okay.
The next 2,000 years was to be the age of Aquarius, that is the water bearer, the symbol of the new age of love and peace. This is, you know, one of the main new age symbols, this age of Pisces.
So he's taking words, historical names, historical groups, and that's where the problem comes in. These are names in history, but then he's rewriting the history about them falsely in so many instances in the novel, and that's where the great criticism has come from.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, when Opus Dei found the Grail, or when they were to find it anyway, his plan was to steal the Grail documents and reveal them to the world himself. This is Sir Lee Teabing.
Okay.
Well, it's through the mouth of Teabing that Dan Brown spends many of his lies about the Catholic Church and its teachings. Langdon and Sophie learn from him that her grandfather had been a grand master of a secret group called the Priory of Sion. Sometimes it's called Zion, sometimes it's called Sion, with an S, whose purpose was to preserve the truth about Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene, which, according to the novel, had been suppressed by the Catholic Church over the centuries by terror, intimidation, and even murder. Now, eventually, the French detectives discovered that Langdon is innocent, and Langdon figures out that the real meaning of the last message in the keystone is that the Grail is buried beneath the small 4.5-foot pyramid directly below the large inverted or upside-down glass pyramid at the entrance to the Louvre, the museum there in Paris. The inverted pyramid is located at a shopping mall below ground. In other words, it's an upside-down pyramid.
Okay.
A big pyramid. It's not a little thing. It's a big glass, giant pyramid.
Yeah. And this actually exists.
It actually exists. Okay. Yes. And it's situated directly below the above ground glass pyramid. There's a big glass pyramid above ground, on which the apex points to the sky in, you know, the regular manner that a pyramid would. We find that the Grail is Mary Magdalene's bones and documents that trace Mary and Jesus' bloodlines. This is really the real Grail. The Grail
that traditionally has been sought was the cup that Jesus used at the Last Supper.
Yes, or the cup that was used to collect the blood by Joseph Arimathea that poured from Christ's side. It's also there's that
on the
version.
Cross of Calvary.
There's that version of the story too.
Okay.
Well, at the end, he goes to the small pyramid and falls to his knees in reverence, thinking that he hears a woman's voice coming to him from the earth, speaking the wisdom of the ages. And at the end of the book, he and Sophie fall in love and arrange to meet in Florence. So that's sort of the the story in a nutshell.
Overall story. Okay. Now, why do you think Dan Brown chose the Louvre Pyramid to end the novel?
Well, I think that's significant. I think that he used the Louvre, the pyramid there, because there's been so much controversy over it. When it was built in 1989, many people felt that this futuristic structure looked out of place in front of the classical architecture of the Louvre. You know, the Louvre was, if I recall right, was built back in the 17th century, 17th or 18th century, I think the 17th century. And although there were others who thought it was a good juxtaposition of the classical and the ultra-modern architectural styles, but perhaps the main reason there's been so much controversy over this pyramid is the claim that it contains 666 glass panes, the mark of the beast in the Book of Revelation, often associated with Satan. I read that the story of the 666 panes originated in the 1980s when an official brochure stated twice that it contained 666 panes, although the same brochure said in another place that it contained 672. Well, the debate continues over exactly how many panes it does have, and the museum citing one figure and the architectural firm that built it and designed it another, some Chinese architect here lives in the United States actually designed it. But the 666 myth resurfaced again in 2003 when Dan Brown used it in his one of his settings in the Da Vinci Code. And he states, quote, this is Dan Brown, quote, "This pyramid, at President Mitterrand's explicit demand, had been constructed of exactly 666 panes of glass, a bizarre request that had always been a hot topic among conspiracy buffs who claimed 666 was the number of Satan," end of quote. Now, scholars have disputed whether or not Mitterrand ever made such a demand, but nonetheless, this whole Da Vinci Code is a conspiracy story to begin with, a conspiracy on the part of the Catholic Church to keep certain things secret that could blow, the whole Christianity apart.
The greatest conspiracy that I've ever heard that the Church tried to subjugate and keep from becoming known over the centuries.
Yes.
The wildest and the most exaggerated and obviously unhistorical situation that supposedly the Church has been able to do for thousands of years, keep this secret about Mary Magdalene being the real Grail of the holy vessel that contained the blood of Jesus in a child.
Well, I believe you said earlier, I think you were quoting Joseph Goebbels, the German minister of propaganda under Hitler, and if you're going to want people to believe something, just make it such a big lie that people can believe that, well, this has to be true, it's so fantastic. But the main reason I think that Brown uses the pyramid for the Grail's location is that the inverted triangle or pyramid symbolizes the sacred feminine.
An inverted triangle is an upside-down triangle.
Yes.
With the point down instead of up.
Right.
Okay.
It symbolizes the sacred feminine in occult circles. And it represents the, in fact, I've spent quite a bit of time looking at this stuff in the on the internet, looking for these various symbols. And he has them in his book, but I wanted to go through and see if I could find some independent source that would use the similar or the same symbols, and I did find some. And it represents the female womb. Moreover, the regular above-ground pyramid, situated directly above, it symbolizes the sacred masculine.
Okay.
And the pentagram, for example, is significant in the novel because it has one triangle placed on top of another triangle, symbolizing the union of the sacred feminine and the sacred masculine.
Okay.
And Brown even, it doesn't say that in the novel, but from what I was able to learn,
okay,
you can see that that's... the meaning,
that's
the symbolism.
Interpretation.
Yes, that's my interpretation of the symbolism.
And many people, that's their general interpretation.
Yes. And Brown even goes so far as to claim that the Star of David, which has two intersecting triangles, represents the union of the two sexes. I don't want to take the time. We could take a whole half-hour session in talking about that, because the Da Vinci Code is just as anti-Jewish as it is anti-Christian.
Oh, really?
In a lot of ways. Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, what is the secret of the Holy Grail, according to the novel, that's revealed so spectacularly in these discovered, supposedly authentic documents?
We suggested it a little bit a while ago, but most people know that the traditional meaning of the Holy Grail is that it is the cup that Jesus used during the Last Supper, as you mentioned a while ago. But Dan Brown has a completely different meaning. He tells us, though, that his characters, through his characters in the novel, Langdon and Teabing, that for thousands of years, humankind had practiced a religion that balanced the masculine and the feminine in a manner in which goddesses and women were highly esteemed. However, the Jews and other peoples over the centuries had degraded the role of women. And we'll come back to this in a later session. Jesus' main reason was to restore goddesses and the sacred feminine. That was Jesus' real reason for coming, according to Dan Brown here in the Da Vinci Code.
Okay.
Was to restore, the goddesses and sacred feminine.
And this, again, according to the fact sheet in the front of the book, has been thoroughly researched.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And to accomplish this, he married Mary Magdalene and fathered a child with her named Sarah. And she was pregnant with their child at his crucifixion, in fact. Brown claims that historians have examined the fact, quote, fact of Jesus and Mary's marriage in great detail. Now, here's what you've been referring to several times. Historians have examined the fact of Jesus and Mary's marriage in great detail, and the historical record is to be found in the Gospel, the Gnostic Gospels. In the Gnostic Gospels, including the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And it was fitting for Jesus to marry Mary because, according to Brown's absurd claim, she was of royal blood of the house of Benjamin, who was the youngest son of Jacob or of Israel, and in Jewish history and, of course, in Judeo-Christian history. And by marrying Jesus and Mary became heirs to Solomon's kingship. In other words, it joined together the tribe of King Saul, who was a Benjamite, with the tribe of David, a Judean. And of course, you know, Christ came from the tribe of Judah.
And of course, David was of the tribe of Judah.
David came from the tribe of Judah. Yes.
Okay. Well. Now, doesn't Dan Brown claim that Jesus appointed, strangely, these things just blow me away when I'm asking these questions. Didn't, in the novel, Dan Brown claim that Jesus appointed Mary Magdalene to head his movement? He calls it a movement rather than the
yes.
church he set up. Okay.
We won't try to refute this now, but because we're going to do that later. But yes, he does. He claims that in addition to making Mary his wife and mother of his child, he appointed Mary to lead his movement. And however, as the story goes, Peter was a male chauvinist who was jealous of Mary's role, so he organized and led his own movement, which persecuted her and replaced Jesus' teachings with his own. what we know, of course, as the teachings of the Catholic Church. According to Brown, in the Da Vinci Code, the Catholic Church launched a smear campaign, quote, smear campaign, to slander her name and label her a prostitute, to lower her status and wipe out the truth about her once high role in the church. Now, again, we'll come back and refute that in a later session.
Okay.
Brown claims that the church resorted to intimidation, violence, and even murder to keep this truth a secret over the centuries. And again, we'll come back to refute that later.
Okay.
To go on with the story, as a consequence of this persecution, Mary was forced to flee with her child to Egypt, then to southern France, where she died. And Brown, through the mouths of his characters, claims that Jesus and Mary's child was the root of the Merovingian royal dynasty that ruled what is parts of present-day France and Germany from the 5th to the 8th centuries. Clovis was the first Germanic king to become a Christian, and he's best known, he's the best one known of this Merovingian royal dynasty.
Okay, now again, we want to clarify that this is what the novel is claiming. Okay, so what then is the secret of the Holy Grail as found in the novel, The Da Vinci Code?
This is implicit in what we said earlier in the session, but according to the novel, the Grail relics consist of the documents, including Gnostic texts, and we're going to explain Gnosticism later, that testify to the bloodlines, as well as the actual bones of Mary Magdalene. That's the Grail. That's it was Mary Magdalene's womb, really, I guess, literally. Her womb held his blood,
sure.
His body, and their child. He says that the Grail documents describing these events were hidden by the Priory of Sion in a secret crypt somewhere, perhaps in or near the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. The Temple Mount, of course, is where Solomon's Temple had been built, and then later on Ezekiel's temple, because the Solomon's temple had been torn down, and then, of course, eventually Herod's temple. And it's where the Rock of the Dome's at today, the great Muslim mosque. I believe it's the third most important of all of the pilgrimage sites for the Muslim world. But the documents had been discovered by the Crusaders. This is according, again, to Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, after they conquered Jerusalem in 1099. In the Priory of Sion and the Knights Templar were organized to keep the secret. What's more, Brown's characters tell us that Mary was the real Holy Grail, not a chalice, as it was ordinarily thought to be. In other words, she held the blood of Christ in her womb.
Okay.
That is, you know, his child. The quest for the Holy Grail, then, is not the search for the chalice that Jesus used in the Last Supper, but for the resting place of Mary Magdalene, as well as the documents that tell the real truth, the, quote, real truth about Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Okay. So as we had said, I think at the beginning of the first session, Dan Brown said he wanted to challenge the commonly accepted understandings of Western culture and Christianity.
Yes.
And this certainly is putting a ton of dynamite explosives under the common understanding of what the Grail was, what Jesus' purpose was, who Jesus was, the relationship of Peter and Jesus and Mary Magdalene and Peter. It just blows the Gospels fragments. And we're going to talk about that as we get. But you keep quoting that Dan Brown says, my sources are real Gospels, are the Gnostic Gospels.
The Gnostic Gospels.
And those were the Gospels we're going to talk about that have been discovered through the years, and some even recently.
Some of them recently, such as the Gospel of Judas.
Okay. But the church has, or even historians, have not accepted those as authentic documents.
As the church didn't, of course, 1900 years ago, 1819 years ago.
So these, some of these statements have been going on for years and years, and Dan Brown put them into the novel, quoting these Gnostic Gospels as, well, here are real sources now that reveal what the Catholic Church has been trying to
hide. Well, unfortunately, there are quite a few scholars who also make such claims, and he relies upon a number of these books. We're not going to spend much time in this series on these books, but we'll mention them in passing,
sure,
at least.
Well, I know you went into some detail before about the people who have tried to verify the Gnostic Gospels, of which there may be something like 80.
Well, the Da Vinci Code claims there's 80. I've never been able to come to anything close to that. There might have been 15 or so, 20 circulating around the first two or three centuries of the church. But there were other. He may be throwing them all together. There were Acts. There were a lot of Acts.
Okay.
There were a lot of epistles or letters of various early church people. They were written by Gnostics. There were even some apocalypses. Things of that sort.
Say a word, Ron, about Gnostic. It's a form of approach to religion that only the elite can understand.
Yeah, and it literally comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means knowledge. And so they're talking about secret knowledge. And Gnostic religions deal with secret knowledge that only an elite few will have privy to. And as I said, we're going to spend probably at least a couple of half-hour sessions telling about Gnosticism, because I don't think you're going to understand where Dan Brown's coming from or the Da Vinci Code without some pretty good knowledge of Gnosticism.
I'd like to throw in here one of the quotes we got from Origen. Origen said the church. Now Origen was around, I believe, 258. Year 258, and he said, the church has four gospels, the heretics have many.
Mm-hmm.
So the Gnostic gospels, these inauthentic claims to be good lives of Jesus or authentic lives of Jesus, has been around from the earliest centuries. So it's nothing really new, although they have discovered a few more in some, what's the famous
Nag Hammadi.
What is it, Nag?
Nag Hammadi.
It was some discovery.
In Egypt.
Archaeological discovery.
Yeah, 1945. They discovered around 52 or 53. They were not all gospels, but several of them were gospels.
Okay.
We'll have occasion to mention them a little bit later on. It was a few years later, if I recall right, that they made the discoveries at Qumran. Qumran were all Old Testament documents.
Oh, it was all Old Testament.
Yes.
And they were found in these clay jars that had been preserved over the centuries.
The Nag Hammadi, they were probably documents that were hidden during the time of Saint Athanasius when he was Bishop of Alexandria, Egypt.
Okay.
At that time, if I recall right, Athanasius told his priest and the people in the various monasteries and under his jurisdiction and his diocese to get rid of those kind of things, that they were not approved by the church and they contained heresies and whatever. And so maybe the monks couldn't bring themselves to destroy them, so they took them and put them in a jar or jars and took them and hid them.
So the Gnostic Gospels, if anybody reads them, that has a traditional knowledge of Christianity, they'll say, boy, these things are really wild.
All we really knew much about the Gnostic Gospels up until 1945 was in the works of a lot of the early church fathers, such as St. Polycarp and St. Irenaeus and people, St. Augustine.
Who trying to refute them.
And so they quoted long passages of it.
All right, I'm going to cut you off, Ron. Your time's running out. May God bless you always and in all ways.